Welcome to More Than a Refresh, a podcast with conversations with the most interesting people you've never met or may never have heard of. Today we are recording from Astoria, Queens, Bellingham, Washington. That's right, I'm on the road. And Dallas, Texas. Our guest today is Elizabeth McCormick. Elizabeth, introduce yourself.
I'm Elizabeth McCormick. Do you want more?
A little bit more. A little bit more would be helpful.
So I am a former U.S. Army Black Hawk helicopter pilot, one of the first 100 women to fly the Black Hawk for the U.S. Army. Now did 8 years of corporate America, and for the last almost 15 years have been a professional motivational speaker.
15 years. So that's interesting. How do you, before we get into that, we now know who you are and what your background is. The reason I sought you out to be a guest was actually, it was odd. You followed me on Twitter. Mm-hmm. I'm like, who is this? And then I did a little research. I'm like, oh, I got to have her. Right. she's got to be on this podcast.
Twitter, now, whatever they're calling itself now, I mean, before it became politically charged, is my favorite platform. I love Twitter. So
yeah, it's interesting. A lot of people have said, you know, people are leaving Twitter in droves. And that's not been my experience. My experience is that a lot of people are still using Twitter/X, especially in tech, which is where I reside. But there is a new platform out there called Blue Sky, which is by Dorsey, and Dorsey's who founded Twitter. And it literally works just like Twitter used to. So you may want to consider it. I think that social media is in late stage at this point. People are realizing how, if it's used as a tool, it's good. If it's not used as a tool, it can be very bad and very toxic. So I don't know. I use it as a tool.
It can be very inauthentic.
Yes.
Right. So like you don't see, for most people, you don't really see who they really are. You see just the what they want you to see. Mm-hmm. With that. So
yeah, I would agree with that. It's funny because I don't know if you did any research, but one of the things that we do is we live in a school bus 6-7 months a year. We travel around the United States. And you, because of that, you know, there's the whole van life movement and all that type of stuff. And you see all these posts. And I got, you know, half the time I'm like, I don't know what these people are doing, but this is not what mobile nomad life is like, right? I mean, it is a simple life and it is full of adventure, but it is not an easy life mm-hmm. by any stretch. But yeah, so outside of the Black Hawk helicopter thing, which we will get into because I think it's fascinating, what's your background beyond that? What made you go that direction?
Oh, I was an unemployed military wife with 5 years of college, almost 3 college degrees, and I couldn't get a job. That's what
was
started.
It an art philosophy or something?
So I mean I have a degree in art, a minor in mathematics, and an associate's degree in engineering. And my intention coming out of college was to go to graduate school for architectural engineering. And when I met what I call very affectionately, or not, the starter husband.
He wasn't production quality yet. He was beta.
No, he was pre-beta. He was not even trainable. So originally when we were dating and talking about getting married, like he was supposed to be stationed at Fort Hood. And I was like, great. University of Texas is nearby. I'll go to grad school for architectural engineering, which was my entire plan. And it all just like, it fell into place so nicely that I just thought everything was meant to be. It had this like rose colored glasses, romantic notion, like, oh, it's meant to be. He's where I want to be. And he's where, you know, it did not work out that way. So,
oh, to be young again.
Oh, so young. So it didn't work out. He ended up at the last minute, his orders got changed to Fort Polk, Louisiana. It didn't even have a Walmart. There was nothing, no jobs, nothing I could do. I was stuck. So, and I felt stuck, and I ended up getting a job in a pizza place after 5 years of college. And I love to eat, but I was not happy. So I had to reevaluate, and, you know, I was 24 years old, and I'm 25, almost 25, no, 24. And I was reassessing like my whole future, like what I was going to do. So, like what could I change? You know, and at the time I didn't realize the marriage would have been the easiest thing to change, you know? So, hey, some people are still on their starter husband, so our spouse, that's all good, all good. But no, mine did not work out. So,
okay.
So I decided if he could be in the Army, why can't I?
That's a fair question. So let's actually explore that a little bit. Mm-hmm. The letting the fairer sex, I guess that's one way to put it. Ladies.
That was the name of a movie. Yes.
That was the name of a movie. Letting ladies into this particular program, piloting Blackhawks. That was relatively new, right? 13 years or something before you joined?
About 13 years. So there's slightly variations in different data, but yeah, about 13 years before that.
So talk to us a little bit about, I mean, what was that like? I mean, you hear, I mean, obviously, especially once women became, I guess, combat able. Not that they weren't, but I mean, allowed.
Oh, that happened much later. So that was like 2008. I mean, that was.
Can you explain that a little bit? Because where does you're flying a Blackhawk helicopter? Where does that transpose to not being in combat? I mean,
right. So what they had determined is that women could be in combat service support. The thing is, like back in the traditional fighting, like World War One and Two foxholes, the combat service support never got up front, right? Never really saw combat. But the fact is from Vietnam, like Korea, it started to change in Korean War and then Vietnam. And then you get into, we were in the Cold War era for a while. And then we hit Iraq the first time. And so the whole face of combat changed. So there's no like, here's the front line, don't cross that line. It's not like that anymore. So they would say combat service support, but the fact is a lot of women were right in the thick of things during you know, our first conflict in Iraq.
Sure.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So the first conflict in Iraq, that was what, 91? I say 90, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And you're saying that
I don't claim to be a historian, so I don't.
Yeah, I'm thinking back, right? It was, I know I was out of high school, which would put it around that time.
Mm-hmm.
But you're saying it wasn't until like 08 when women could be.
They finally lifted the restriction, right? Where okay. They said, okay, women are going to be in combat. And all of us went, we have been. Like, where have you been?
Living?
You know,
have you seen my starter husband?
Hello. So, I mean, I personally was not in combat. I was in during, I joined right after the Iraq, the first, I called the first Dust Bowl ended. And I was in during, like my unit had just gotten back from Somalia. I was at my Bosnia, Kosovo. I was in during that time frame.
Okay.
So, and then I got out May 2001, right before the next one started. So I just kind of bridged that gap where I was right in between the two.
So what is it? Talk to us a little bit. I mean, we know how you ended up in the military.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, starter husband helped with that. A little bit of boredom, I would think, being in a pizza restaurant.
Dissatisfaction, I think.
Dissatisfaction.
So I, you know, what I've realized And I would love the listeners to understand, like, dissatisfaction, like, is a choice. Like, I look back now and I was like, I could have settled. I could have been happy in that spot being a wife and working in a pizza place and paying the bills and everything. But I chose not to be, which meant I was searching for something more and better. And I think I did okay, but may not always be the case, right?
Mm-hmm. Well, everybody has and you made a really good point here. You made a choice. And for those of us who are younger, who might be listening to this, I would think that your circumstances are your own and you can change them. That doesn't mean it's a good choice. Doesn't mean it's an easy choice. Doesn't mean there won't be work to be done. Doesn't mean that you'll make the right choice, but you do have that choice.
Your circumstances do not define your future.
So talk to us a little bit about that.
Yeah. So, I mean, the fact is we always have choices, right? I think a lot of people feel like they're powerless and they don't have choices, but we make choices and micro choices every single day. Like what we think, what we say, what time we wake up, how we wake up, what attitude we bring, what we eat, what we don't eat, if we work out, if we don't work out, if we take the stairs or we take the elevator. Like our entire day is full of micro choices, and those can either be positive or they can be negative. And they can either give you momentum and advance you forward or not, right? Our choices, the choices we make, make us.
So let me ask you something. And I mean, we have this whole outline here and we'll get to it, but you touched on something that, you know, a lot of people today would be like, I didn't have a choice, or I don't have a choice, or I can't do this because of that, whatever the case may be. Mm-hmm. What is it that you would say? I mean, we can clearly polish the doorknob and make it all shiny. But what do you say to the person who is, I mean, you and I are sitting in a fairly privileged position. It's not that we didn't work for it. We did, but we are, I mean, we're paying our bills. I mean, we're on a podcast, right? Who would have thought? I mean, and you're an inspirational leader, public speaker. These folks that are, you know, they're living paycheck to paycheck, hopefully, right? Maybe food scarcity is in their existence.
I grew up worse than that. Like I grew up with my dad would go out and hunt squirrel. Like that was, yeah, we were eating, we thought it was chicken, right?
That's a very little chicken.
Right? So, I mean, it was a little stringy. But, you know, I grew up like so poor. My dad was in construction. He built our own house with his own hands so we would have something. I mean, we didn't have any money. We took in my great grandfather and his Social Security helped us keep the lights and heat on. I didn't start off with privilege. I mean, I grew up horribly poor. My parents divorced when I was 10 years old. Neither one of them had any money after that. And I remember looking at my mom saying, what's the big deal? Budget. And then she gave me all of her bills and all of her income and everything. And I did it. And it wasn't positive every month. It was negative. And I'm like, oh, well, like I thought you go to work, you made enough. She didn't even make enough. So it was like constantly in the hole. And, you know, that fires me up. That's what gets me where I'm like, I'm not settling. I'm going to do whatever I have to do. I've worked two jobs before. I've, you know, I had huge crippling loans from going to college. I had a volleyball scholarship that paid some of it, but it didn't pay all of it. My parents didn't pay anything. I did loans. And then when I couldn't pay the loans from the pizza place, I joined the military. You know, it was a choice. So sometimes I think we're so stuck in where we are that we have to really get quiet and still and think about what we could do. What is possible? What can we change? And sometimes the only thing we can change is ourselves, our attitude, and how we show up with what we have. And sometimes we can make big sweeping changes that are scary, that nobody else wants, you know, but we know we have to make those for ourselves. And no one can tell you listening, right? No one can tell you what those right decisions are because you're the only one who can make them.
So you and I are of a particular, and you're Gen X, mm-hmm. As am I. We have a very, very different perspective, I think. And I think every generation has their perspective, don't get me wrong. But Gen X, we came from, I didn't grow up quite that poor. I wasn't hunting squirrel. But I certainly, I do remember, you know, Budget Gourmet and Salisbury steak out of a microwave. And, you know, back when microwaves weren't shielded.
Hamburger Helper and tuna.
Helper, that's right. Or SpaghettiOs, you know. coming home.
To stretch it.
Yeah, exactly. You know, add a little water to the tomato sauce.
And Spam because we couldn't afford the ham. Did that bring back a memory?
Yeah, it did.
And our listeners from Hawaii are going, what? That's what we don't
know. I love that. No, we, the point, you know, we didn't have helicopter parents. We had, go figure it out parents.
Mm-hmm.
If they were around, like not trying to embarrass my mom, but she was married 4 times. She's been divorced 4 times, right? It's what it was. Mm-hmm. And now I look at, my kids are grown. Well, I should say adults, they're still growing. And I look at the way they're approaching life and I can't even grasp it. It's like, just go and do. It will fall in place. Now, it's great to have a plan.
Maybe.
Maybe. Well, but it's going to fall in place.
Something will.
Yeah, exactly. Something. Yeah. If you don't do, nothing happens.
Mm-hmm.
Right? You got to do. And maybe, the way I approached it. So I've got a blown out ankle. And it's blown out because mm-hmm. I convinced myself at 25 years old that I knew how to do roofing. I didn't. In fact, I don't go on roofs anymore because of that. But I ended up falling off the roof and crushing my leg and my ankle. But the point is, I did. Right? I went and did it. I went and got things done. I learned from it. I made a mistake, and then I moved on. And now I'm, paying for it a little bit now. Mm-hmm. But if you don't move forward, you're not going to get anything in life.
Yeah.
Right?
Try.
Yeah, at least try.
Experiment. The worst thing that happens is you mess up and you learn.
Well, the worst thing that happens is you're dead, but then it doesn't matter.
Well, that's that one. Yeah.
Right? Because you're dead. So,
Actually, if you die doing it, you don't care anymore. So it's okay.
Exactly. Right? I mean, so go for it. I mean, I've certainly done my share of crazy things.
But the thing is, we did things without cameras and cell phones watching everything that we do.
Oh,
thank goodness.
No kidding. Well, a lot of my mistakes can only be remembered over too much scotch. So, which is a good thing, I think. Why Blackhawks? I mean, outside, I'm a guy, so they're badass, right? They're awesome, but why Blackhawks? Why not something else in the military?
So when I decided to join, I did a lot of research, all that college, all that writing papers and stuff. So I did a lot of research and I went onto the base and back then on a military base, the only restaurant they had was Burger King. That was like the fancy restaurant. So I sat, it was a contract thing. I sat in the Burger King every morning as officers and soldiers were coming in for their breakfast and coming out, right? So I sat there and if I saw an officer coming, because I knew with my college, I could go in as an officer. Mm-hmm. So I sat there and if I saw an officer come in and I said, can I ask you a few questions? And I had 3 main questions I asked everyone. I was like, what would you have to do if you had to do it over? What would you do differently than what you did do? So pretty much the same question, but I went a little slightly different tack. And then the third one was pretty simple. What's the coolest job? What do you think is the coolest job?
Okay.
Everybody said it was being a helicopter pilot. Most of the commissioned officers, lieutenant, captain, major, general, all the way up, colonel, all those, they all said, I'd be a warrant officer.
Hmm.
Which I was like, well, I don't know what that is, but okay, I wrote it down. You know, so I did more research, ended up going out to the flight line and talking to the pilots. I did not even occur to me at that moment. They were all men. They helped me. They told me what the process was. And then I started the process through the recruiting station, which was fun because they all said no.
They all said, well, let's get to that actually. But first, what is a warrant officer?
So warrant officers were started during the Civil War days when the enlisted get pulled off to do other duties. They're out on the front lines. They are, you know, painting. Nowadays, if they're bored, they're painting rocks, right? So they're cleaning, they're doing all the crappy jobs, basically. So, and then the higher the enlisted go, they become sergeants all the way up to sergeant major of the Army, and all the different, there's multiple different ranks of sergeants. They're leading all the enlisted. And so they're pulled off to do a lot of duties all the time. Well, the officers are groomed from the beginning to lead, and they're actually leading the unit, the larger units in scale, depending on the rank. So what they realized early on in the Army is that they needed someone to take care of horsepower. So back then it was horses. Mm-hmm. They needed someone to take care of the general's horses. And they needed the same person to take care of the horse every day. They didn't want it switching out. They wanted that consistency and proficiency.
Mm-hmm.
So they created the warrant officer corps to take care of the horses. Now it's horsepower of a different kind, right? It's helicopters and higher end, like the nuclear specialist that has the football at the White House. That's a warrant officer. Warrant officers receive an appointment as an officer based on technical and tactical proficiency. They get to do their job, and they get left alone.
And in the military, that is saying something.
That is unique. There's not very many. Most of them are pilots in the Army. Like I said, there's ones that are in quartermaster, and certain fields have those technical tacticians that are warrant officer in their field, but it's extremely rare.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So as a woman, I mean, the way it's brokenly designed, but as a woman, you're told no over and over and over. How do you move forward? How do you get, what did you have to do for them to be like, oh, she's 5'5", but she can still fly this helicopter?
I'm 5'5". Luckily, I have really, really long arms. That's like one of the criteria. Like I was like a quarter inch from being too short in the legs to meet for the pedals, but I can reach everything because they thought for sure I was too short and I was going to fail. So, you know, the first barrier was the recruiter, and he was like, you can't do this. And, you know, and I talk about this now in my speeches, when I talk about overcoming obstacles is sometimes you have to believe in yourself more than anyone else believes.
Mm-hmm.
And that's hard. Like, that's not easy. Because we're kind of conditioned and wired to listen to what everybody else says, right? And what they think. And so here I walk into the recruiting station. He's in a position of authority, right? And I'm like, I want to go warrant officer flight training program. And he's like, he just laughs. He's like, you can't do that. And so all I knew is I'd done the research. I knew I met the criteria. And so I asked him, I just kept questioning. And questioning with curiosity. I think one of the biggest problems we have is when we're met with resistance and we don't get curious enough. We accept it. And we say, oh, I can't. Okay. And having that curiosity and really sparking that curiosity within you that you need to know what's going on. And that's not just with a situation like this, but any situation you're in. I think when we're young, we have lots of curiosity. And then the adults in our lives are like, quit asking, stop, you know, we stop. And I think as adults, we need to bring it back because it serves us as adults to understand what's going on around us more. So So I asked him, why not over and over and over again until he said something I could counteract.
Well, you actually touched on something. That curiosity. The system is designed to destroy that.
Mm-hmm.
It's not just parents. It's society as a whole has been engineered or groomed or taught, whatever terminology you want to use, that there is a point where you just say, okay. And they want that because if everybody is like you, and frankly, not like me, I can't remember who said it, but there was a quote. It's like they basically said, we can't have a bunch of independent thinkers.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Because if everyone's an independent thinker, if nobody's a conformist, it's going to lead to chaos. Well, I don't agree with that, but there is a thought process there, right? Because you need people to sit in the assembly line of profit. And it may be military, it may be capitalist.
We need followers as much as we need leaders.
Yes.
But the fact is, by society, like I'm an advocate of DISC and the assessments, and I've looked at all the data, and that holds true societal, in no matter what society or what culture, is the largest percent of the four personality and communication styles, the largest percent doesn't like change. They're followers.
Right?
So we've already got that built in and baked in, right? For that personality. So why try to push everyone else into a conforming mentality?
Well, I mean, that's the question, right? And I think that the other part of it is, from a human perspective, I think that it's important. Sure, you can be a follower and a leader, right? There are times to do both. I've long learned that if there is a boutique and I'm with my wife, I will be following her into that boutique. No matter what I say, no matter how much I protest. And in fact, it's funny because we were just out. We were in Sandpoint, Idaho, just this past week, which is a beautiful little town, lots of boutiques, things like that. And we were walking and she wasn't going into them. And I point blank said, I'm like, what is, are you feeling okay? Right. Am I about to get into a fight that I didn't know I did something wrong? Right. What's happening here? And she's like, I'm just feeling the town. I'm like, okay. I don't understand. Right. I'm just going to follow.
Not normal for you.
Yeah. No, this is, well, I mean, it's kind of like, if she ever gets quiet, she's not a quiet person and I love her for it. But when she gets quiet, I'm like, okay, what am I doing? Right. Just let me have it now so we can move beyond. Right.
Is it like when a woman says, fine, I'm fine.
You're in trouble. Women say I'm fine or lying.
They're processing all your transgressions mentally, is what they're doing. They're
trying to decide whether or not you're going to be a starter husband.
It could happen. Sometimes a starter is a keeper. We'll just leave it there.
Yeah, sometimes. all right. So you decided on Blackhawks. What was the question? What was it that you finally convinced this recruiter? Look, yes, I'm a woman and I'm going to fly these better than you ever could.
Well, so I had to ask him over and over again, like, why not? It was like, well, you need perfect eyesight. I have that. You need perfect physical condition. Well, now in my speeches, I say I used to have that. So, right. I haven't had that in a while now, but I had it then. He's like, you need a college degree. I almost have three, you know, so, you need leadership experience. And I had that in college too. So everything he said, I had an answer for. And when I finally asked him why not, and he didn't have anything, he just kind of stuttered and sputtered. And then he finally said, I don't know how to do the paperwork.
Isn't it just the same paperwork with a different biological designation? No.
It was a huge process, and he had never gone through it before. So I think, So the secret story that I can't tell in my speeches because I don't have enough time, and I try not to make the Army look worse than it already is and in my presentations. I think the reality behind the scenes, he really did not know how to do the paperwork, but he also wasn't going to get any points towards his quotas of the recruiting for his recruiting command. He wasn't going to get any credit for bringing in, and yet it was going to take a lot of time. So I think that's was the real barrier there, but he also didn't know how to do the paperwork. That's the short answer.
We have a recruiter who I actually come from a military family. I did not serve, but I was afraid of getting arrested. I know they have quotas. Mm-hmm. How is it that you, I mean, I'm going to assume it changed, it's different now, but then how is it that you don't count?
It probably is the same now, I'm going to say. Because bringing in an officer does not fill
the role. So this wasn't a woman thing. This was an officer thing.
Warrant officer specifically, but okay. Whether it was an officer or warrant officer, it didn't fill a spot he needed to fill, not just in basic training, but he needed to fill a spot in a advanced, they call AIT, advanced individual training. He didn't have a spot to fill in a job. Like, he has so many cooks he has to fill. That's the first thing he told me I should do is be a cook. So he had so many cooks to fill, and he had so many infantry. I couldn't do that because that's combat, right? Infantry. And he had so many air assault, and he had so many of these other jobs, right? What in the military we call military occupational specialty, MOS. He had so many MOSs he needed to fill. And I wasn't any of them.
Man. So. Okay. So you're saying, you say you suspect now that it really hasn't changed that much. And based on what you're saying, I would probably agree with you. Not that I know, but I would agree with you, because I was thinking along the lines of it was because you were a woman. It had nothing to do with that, which is actually, I mean, that's kind of nice to hear, frankly, that it was purely, you were a round peg and he needed square ones, right? That's all it was. What was the training like? I'm trying to approach this from a very, I don't even know, but like, very kid glove kind of thing. But the reality is, I mean, I guessed your height. It was 5'5". You said you have long arms, but I mean, there are biological differences, right? There's
no, none.
Mm-mm. None? There's none?
No. Wait. It wasn't bad. In basic training. So by the time I got in, right, it was a process. It was like a 6-month. I had to go through kind of like your tribunal, right? I had to be interviewed by a panel and of higher ranking officers. I had to do a flight physical. I had to take flight aptitude skills tests and all the other regular entrance tests, but I also had to do a flight aptitude skills test and score high. And then I had to type, all the paperwork. Now, remember, the recruiter wasn't helping me. So I'm figuring all this stuff out. So I sat in the recruiting station and I'm on this old typewriter with carbon paper forms, and you can't make a single mistake. Right. Like, you make one mistake, it's rip it out, start over. So I'm typing, all these forms in, because he was not willing to spend any time to help me. So I'm, filling out all the forms and I'm doing everything. And like, when I went to take my physical, the flight doctor, he's like, well, you should have taken all your testing first. What if you fail your testing? It's like, I'm not going to fail my testing. Like, I have a mathematics degree. I took calculus 4. I'm pretty sure I can handle a standardized test. Like, leave me alone. So I said, I've got an appointment. Let's just do this physical, and I had to push, because he's like, well, and then he was like, well, don't you know it's hard? I was like, okay, it's hard. Guess what? Lots of things in life are hard. You choose your hard, and he just, every step, when I went to take the testing, they were like, don't you know this test is hard? I'm like, calculus 4 is hard. Like, this is not hard. So it was a struggle all the way through. And then basic training was actually not as hard, because, but I was in the very last class of all women in basic training before they went co-ed. So like the very class after mine was went co-ed. It seemed to happen a lot to me in the Army. That happened. And then when I went through flight school, I had to go through candidate school next. I'll circle that. But I had to, when I went through flight school, I was in the last class that was still in Huey's before they switched to a civilian training model. So it was like all these things were in transition and flux when I went through. But warrant officer candidate school, that school had one standard. It was a warrant officer standard, and they were not lowering standards for women that were coming through. And that one, that was hard. So I had to push myself harder physically than I'd ever pushed, and had to run 2 miles, 3 miles, 4 miles, 5 miles in boots, in gear, the same, exact same as the men. And that's course.
That's not a light pack.
And with the full, the dummy made a rubber rifle that's the same weight, though, as a regular rifle, right? So, but we started that course with 7 women. And out of that, and the end of that 6-week course, only 2 of us finished.
Wow. So, well, actually, this is an interesting, possible power moment. How many of the men washed out?
We only had one man wash out. And that was only because he was a National Guard that had attended the course to go back to his National Guard unit, because they did that. There was active National Guard and reserves all in this course. And he had a heart attack.
Oh.
He had a heart attack during one of the physical fitness. Like, we would do physical fitness in the morning, classroom work, physical fitness in the morning, breakfast, classroom work, lunch, classroom work, and then the end of the day we would spend another hour to 2 hours in physical fitness, and then we'd eat dinner sweaty. And it was this was in Alabama, and I was there in July and August. It was really hot.
That's terrible.
I remember one day we were doing jumping jacks and I lost count at 400. So you just totally have an out-of-body experience, and where you don't even feel your body anymore, but you don't quit. That's what they were looking for. They were looking for who was going to quit when it got hard. Because if candidate school was hard, flight school was harder. So they didn't want people quitting in combat or quitting in an emergency procedure in a real mission. So they needed to see how you would perform under stress and duress.
Well, I think that's actually a good point. It comes back to, your philosophy of you got choices. When you fail, you're choosing to fail to a certain degree, I would think. It's not that there aren't circumstances that make things happen, right? But you do have an opportunity. Just because A didn't work doesn't mean you can't shift to B to make that a success, right?
Well, I would say may not choose to fail. You choose to try, right? Or to do something. But you can choose to learn from it or not. Like, when you get stuck in that failure and you're not going to, keep doing the same thing. That's a choice, right?
Yeah. And what I meant by that is, when you reframe just like you said, is that if you learn from it, is it a failure?
Mm-hmm. No.
Right. I mean, yeah, it's a lesson, because nobody's perfect. We're failing every day, right? It's something, right? Maybe I'll give you a perfect example. I fail demonstrably every single morning to not get coffee grounds on the counter, no matter how hard I try.
I have the solution for you, JD.
Okay.
Don't drink coffee.
That's not going to happen.
I'm just saying, there's a choice, right?
My wife once tried to get me to switch to tea. And I made an honest effort. It lasted 2 weeks and people were about to die. So I switched back to coffee.
Well, you can use a Keurig with a little K-cup.
Yeah, little K-cups. I don't make that much money. I can't afford it. It's a lot of waste on lots of levels there.
Lots of landfill use there.
Yeah. So you made it through basic training.
Yeah.
And then you go, is it officer candidate after that?
Warrant officer candidate.
Warrant officer candidate. What was that? You said that was harder. So what was?
Oh, that was hard. Only because as a woman, I had to meet all the same physical standards as the men. So And it was, like I said, physical fitness in the morning, physical fitness in the late afternoon in the heat of the day. And then if you messed something up, you had to do a third physical fitness in the evening when everybody else was studying. So it was like a detention. They called it demerits. So fortunately, I only had to do those once. I learned really fast. Like, you need that time to study and get, and, you know, we had to have our socks rolled and our toiletries all laid out in a certain way. And we had to have all of our clothing positioned 1 inch apart in the closet. So we learned, because it was a 6-week course, and we learned. So we had one person with a ruler go through and make sure they would go through every single person's room and just do the closet part. And we had another person go in and make sure all the socks were good. And we started really working as a team by the last like 2 weeks of the 6-week course. We kind of had it down where everybody just had one task to do and would go through the whole, because by that time it was just two women, Sherry and I, we were the only ones. And so like we were on the same, it wasn't separated. We were right next door to the men, and we had to share the same bathroom as the men.
Great look. I love that look.
Yeah. So, I mean, the thing is, you typically think, oh, it's dirty. Ooh, you know, but we had to keep it so clean. We had to clean our own spaces, right? So we had to keep it so clean that it never was an issue. But like, because there was like 40 men and two women, like we got up at literally 3 minutes in the bathroom in the morning. we were brushing our teeth while we were taking care of other bodily functions, because we had to be fast in there.
Multitask.
We had to be fast because there were 40 guys waiting to get in. Like you learn to be part of that team and be a team player in a huge way.
So, you know, you just brought up, because you said that, you know, physically, the standards were the same between men and women. Mm-hmm. I'm going to get in trouble for saying this, but generally speaking, men have an advantage because of testosterone. Mm-hmm. Muscle mass, as well as, you know, our lungs have more capacity, as well as testosterone allows us to recover faster.
And they're also typically larger, which means they have a longer stride when running, and there's a lot of advantages. Yes.
Right. So my question for you was, did you experience, I mean, obviously you guys, everyone's pushing themselves so hard that maybe this didn't happen, but did you experience a situation where the men, they weren't in better shape? I mean, you guys by the end are probably in the same shape for your body type. But mm-hmm. did you see a situation where the men were just able to recover faster than yourself? So you had to push, you had to do like 1.25 versus one, because, well, that just baseline science of testosterone.
Mm-hmm. You know, we never sat around and said, oh, are you sore? Are you recovered? We were too busy.
How are your toes?
Do your legs hurt? Do your calves hurt? Yes, all the time, every day. Because we did stuff every day. Like, there was no recovery day. So, no, I mean, we didn't sit around talking about stuff like that. So I don't think I ever really noticed that it took me longer to recover than the guys. I will say, to my advantage, I came straight from basic training. A lot of the other, where fitness was, it wasn't as intense, but it was still pretty high. And then before basic training, I was married to a military soldier and an army soldier. And I did physical fitness with this unit until somebody ratted and I got in trouble and had to not do that anymore. So then I was working out by myself because I knew what was coming. Like, I knew what was coming. And I think a lot of the ones that were coming in to Warrant Officer Candidate School straight from being on a unit for several years, didn't have that higher level of conditioning. So that did help me. It still had to push harder than I ever had pushed on physically on anything in my life. So to make it happen.
Yeah. I mean, I think about it now, you know, I'm going to be 51 here in just a couple of months. And every once in a while you say, oh, I could do that. And I'm like, no, I couldn't. Not now. No, I explained I can do everything that I could do when I was 25. It just hurts more and I'm slower at it.
I will tell you that I, because in the Army, so I think it's different now from talking to, they do the physical fitness test is different and they put more emphasis on core strength than we did then. Back then it was, all we did was train the PT test, the physical fitness test. We would do push-ups, sit-ups, run, push-ups, sit-ups, run, push-ups, sit-ups, run every single day. Well, you do that 5 to 7 days a week, it starts tearing you down. And so I've had shoulder surgery already. I've had my knees hurt, my ankles hurt. I can't run anymore. I can swim. I can walk. I can do other things, but like it did its damage. It had a toll on doing that when you do that every single day. And I served just shy of 8 years. So, and even in the units, that's all we did. We just prepped for the test, which isn't really a true, and I was happy to see that our, the military physical fitness test is putting more emphasis on what's actually needed in combat, which is a more overall fitness and a core fitness that helps you be able to handle yourself in situations.
So when you say handle yourself in situations, are we talking about a mentality or or both?
Physically. So if you think about like you're wearing, we call it flak jacket, right? We're wearing a ballistic jacket. That's weight in your midsection, you know, so all your shoulder and upper body strength isn't helping you be able to handle carrying a heavy ruck with a ballistic jacket on, with a belt, with everything else, and then be able to twist and turn and move your body the way you need to move in the potentially in the potential combat areas, right? And what we do. And so that's what came out of a long-term study. And they said, okay, we need to do more. So now they have to do a plank challenge and they have to do more than just sit-ups, which is only your upper abdomen.
Well, you think, I know the military isn't exactly known for progressiveness. But you'd think that they would, I totally understand it. If it ain't broke, don't fix it. I totally get that.
They're extremely resistant to change.
Yeah.
First of all, you've got the whole government piece.
Right.
And then you've got the whole bureaucracy, what it takes to make a change piece. Then you've got the whole, you know, how do you change however many million people are in at the same time? Kind of, I mean, it's just the entire infrastructure is built to not change.
No, and that's true. I mean, and you see it. I mean, there's been many a movie that are, you know, they're all fiction, but there many a movie that someone's trying to change from the inside. And the military, largely outside of using tanks instead of horses, you know, and still using the term cavalry, it doesn't, as I understand, does not change. It just kind of moves forward at a very steady, persistent, slow, reliably expensive thing. So yeah, I mean, well, and that goes to, I mean, you were a catalyst of change. Like you said, one of the first, 100 Black Hawk woman pilots, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean,
and they didn't want me there. They did. I will tell you, I saw it. Like there was myself and one other female, right? So let's see, there was myself and one other female in candidate school, but we were, because of our scores, we were in different classes. So we weren't in the same class, and there was a big bubble of people that were trying to get in. So there was like a big gap. There was like, she was like 7 classes behind me. And so, cause you get moved into flight school based on your scores from candidate school. So I got moved up and I had to go through basic. I went through flight school, the only female, not just the only female, but the only female for 5 classes ahead of me and the 6 classes after me. So 12 classes, 20 students in a class, 240 pilots. And there was one woman. Like, they did everything they could to fail me. They did everything they could to make it harder than it really was. And the physicality of flying it by itself, the men struggled at first. I just struggled longer because I got a flight instructor who didn't want to teach me. So, you know, that happened. When I got to my unit, I cut my hair super short, like at the barbershop, like a man. Cut my hair super short because I wanted to do everything I could to fit in and not draw any attention to who I was. And when I started flying generals, I had my hair in a braid. Well, you wear a helmet. The helmet's molded to your scalp. So I had a helmet on. I had to take my braid out because it was never in the same spot. I had to take the braid out. So that meant I had hair in my collar. And the general saw hair and calls my commander and says, I don't want to see hair. So then you have the choice, like cut your hair or fly the mission. Like it was pretty easy for me. I'm going to fly the mission. So it's just hair. It'll grow back. So I cut my hair like super short at the barber's that day because that's what I had to do to fit in.
So this is just fascinating to me. I don't have a problem at all with women in the military, but I've certainly heard all of the propaganda for and against. Mm-hmm. As someone who's been through this and succeeded at this, would you recommend to other ambitious women who are seeking a military career to go down this path?
It depends. It depends. Do they want to fly? If they want to fly, the little known fact is that the Army has the most pilot spots.
Really?
Yes, I know. Everyone assumes it's
the
Air Force.
Well, that's right? Like, I was like, wait, isn't that what the whole point of the Air Force is?
Nope. The Air Force moves people and power. They move people and equipment. So that is their job. So they have massive, big jets, refueling jets, cargo jets, big aircraft, turboprop jets, right? So they have big aircraft that cost hundreds of million, if not billion dollars.
They've got aircraft that can fly tanks.
They don't have very many of them, though, because they cost that much. Yeah. Okay. Helicopters, in contrast, like the Black Hawk, and there's some that cost less, that are smaller and cost less. The Black Hawk was around 20 million. Okay. So we can buy 10 of those for the price of one of these. And they move, and we move people shorter distances in the ground in places airplanes can't land. So we need a lot more of them. So there actually are more pilot spots in the Army than the Air Force has, because it's based on the number of airframes that they're in their military table of equipment. They call it the MTO. Okay. That they're supposed to have.
So if they are looking to be a pilot, you would recommend it, but maybe not for, say, infantry or something else?
They're still not letting, even though they're allowed combat, they're still not, like the first women went through Ranger school and didn't have a unit to go to. They weren't allowing them at the unit level in the Army. So I wouldn't recommend infantry, but for any other job. but infantry and rangers and ones like that, for any other job. Honestly, the Air Force treats their people better. Their bases are in better places. So, and the Air Force treats women better.
Well, I have a cousin that was in the Air Force, and she had nothing but positive things to say. And it wasn't like, you know, I have been ordered to speak nicely. She is affirming of her situation. She was I don't know exactly what she did, but I do know that it involved listening and the Russian language. I had
some military intelligence missions with linguists in the back listening in different languages. Yes.
Yeah. And I mean, she did. She was like, I because my youngest, Annabelle, was considered age-weighted military. And her mom, my starter wife, I actually was very against it. And I said, well, at least, I mean, I have a cousin who's a woman in the military. And her whole thing was, I didn't have any problems in the Air Force. I've heard of problems in the other segments, but.
Yeah, so when the Air Force decided to let women into aviation, okay, a lot of that came from the top down, right? They said, okay, let's do a whole class of women pilots together. okay, for their first class. So there wasn't okay. one. It was a whole class that was the first. The Army said, let's do one and see how it works out. Okay, we had one. She made it. All right, now let's pick another one. And so one at a time. I mean, look at me. 12 classes, only female, right? So that's like mathematically we can figure out I was one of the first 100, but the Army won't release any data on that because I don't think it makes them look very good, quite honestly. But, it was a whole different mentality about how they were going to implement and how difficult they were going to make it on those they were letting in versus the Air Force knew that women would succeed and they wanted them to succeed. So it's a whole different attitude and mentality, I think, at least back then. I certainly hope it's gotten better, although I hear from some women that are currently serving as I speak for some military units when they can afford me. And sometimes I hear, it's gotten better. And other times I hear like, no, it's not. There's still a lot of problems. But I think it's also, it's almost like it's generational change, right? So the culture within the military is so fixed and hard in its mindset that it just requires a long time for the younger generations that are a little bit more open and fluid to get into those positions of authority and power.
Okay, so let's not. I don't want to. I mean,
rest way over into.
No, I think it's great. Honestly, I just know that we don't have a whole lot of time. So, let's talk about leadership because this is what you do now, right? I mean, you're on my Facebook feed all the time. I'm just constantly on my Facebook feed, telling me how I can be so much more.
I can do it, you could do it, JD.
I'll tell you what. I don't think
I'm not that special. And if I could do it,
I don't know. I don't know that people can handle more JD. I'm pretty sure the producer's going, no. But how did you, okay. So you leave the military, you spent 8 years in the military being told, when to poop, how to dress, what you're going to eat, where to fly. I'm going to make the bold assumption that there was a whole lot of little words like misogyny and sexism and
another podcast to talk about any of that.
Yeah. So I'm going to assume all that. And then you leave. You're like, oh, hey, I've served.
I was injured.
Oh, you were injured.
I was injured and medically retired with benefits out of the military. But
during a mission or training or?
Kind of. It was during Kosovo.
Okay.
And at the time I was a single parent. And they didn't want to send me to Kosovo and have me lose my daughter. They actually liked my daughter more than me. So, no, I'm not kidding. They really did. They liked my daughter more than me. She was this little bubbly, let's put it this way. We had 73 people at her fifth birthday party. And every single one of them brought a Barbie doll. Okay, because that's about all that our military store sold for girls. So, everybody adored my daughter. Like, we would go, when I first got to the unit, and you're first meeting people, and we'd go to there was like a monthly dinner, right? Where we all would go to a restaurant in Germany together. And she would literally, I would be sitting there and she would get out of the booth and go and walk around and introduce herself to everyone at like 3.5, 4 years old. So
living a social butterfly.
Social butterfly. And she still is. And they loved her. Like, they loved and adored her. And I think they tolerated me in association. So, I mean, I did my work. I always performed and did a great job, but like socially, like they loved her. So when it came time to deploy, we had to keep someone back as the rear detachment commander, which is not usually a warrant officer. And they pulled me aside and they're like, look, we don't want you to have to send your daughter back to live with your ex. So we want to keep you back as rear detachment commander, but here's the problem. If we deploy again at any point, we can't hold you back a second time. Like, it's a risk. You either go now and it's 6 months, 8 months, a year, we don't know, or it could be a full scale deployment later. And I was like, I'll take the now. She's still little. I'll take the now. So I was rear detachment commander. Well, during that, half the doctors were sent to Kosovo, half, you know, everybody from my unit, except for me. And I had to handle it, everything. And during that time, I didn't get to fly a whole lot because most of, and I flew back and forth from Germany to Kosovo to support the mission and ferry paperwork and do sensitive item inventory and all the things that a commander has to be accountable for. I had to take care of. And I got this really bad summer cold, like really bad, and it wouldn't go away. So I finally went to the doctor and he's like, well, just take some Sudafed. And I'm like, okay, I have been, but okay. You know, and he goes, if it's not gone in 2 weeks, come back. So I went back in 2 weeks because it wasn't gone. And he's like, well, let me see. And he goes, ding, to my forehead. And I'm like, ah, you know, he goes, oh, you have a sinus infection. Here's some antibiotics. They didn't work. I'd already been sick for almost 2 months and it was too deep seated it was antibiotic resistant. And so that started a 6 month journey to getting seen by an ENT when there were only two in all of Germany for all the soldiers and airmen.
Huge presence in Germany.
Yeah. And there were only two ENT specialists. So, and I was a 30 day wait to get for each appointment. And so I'd go in for an appointment and they're like, well, you need a CT scan. And it was a 30 day wait for a CT scan. And then I'd have to wait another 30 days after the CT scan to be seen by the doctor. And so like at the end, it was about 5.5 months. I was horribly ill. I'd lost a ton of weight. My body was fighting off this heavy infection. And I looked like my unit came back from deployment and they thought I had cancer. I was so emaciated and gaunt and had lost a ton of weight. I was the same weight as I was in middle school. I was so thin and ill. And they finally, I got sent to a German doctor. I had a doctor look out for me. And it's a long story about that one. But a doctor looked out for me and sent me to a German hospital in my own town, down the street from my apartment, and which I should have happened months ago. And they got me in for surgery and had to break up this. It was a big surgery. So they had to break up all the infection and everything. But after the surgery, I was having issues with one of my ears and things didn't feel right. And I was having some dizziness. And so the German doctor said that the military waited so long to properly treat me that I had scar tissue damage in my eustachian tube and inner ear, one ear. And the military doctor said the German doctor screwed up.
Do we know which is which?
We're pretty sure it's scar tissue damage from the infection running unheated. And yeah, I'm pretty sure the German doctor, who was excellent, did not screw up. So, but, doesn't matter because as military, you're property, you don't you can't sue, you can't do anything. Right. So they spent a year trying to fix me. And, after the year they couldn't fix me. So they decided to process me out of the military with retirement. And that happened May 2001. Now let's do a little analysis here. May 2001, 3 days later, I got an interview after I got home to Texas. I got an interview from a new website back then called monster.com. Nailed it. Got the job. Had a job. September 11th happens. The unit I was with goes to Afghanistan. I would have had to have gone to Afghanistan because I didn't go to Kosovo. My ex-husband was suing me for custody when I got back in country. So I would have lost custody of my daughter forever had to have sent her back to him. And a month after September 11th, I met my keeper husband on a blind date.
All fell into place.
So within 6 months of getting out of the military, I knew I'd been given a gift with a career-ending injury, but it really was a gift. So I didn't have to send my daughter to live with my ex. I got to keep maintain custody of her for her sake. Sure. I got to, I, you know, I had a job. I met the guy, and we just celebrated our, don't do math here, y'all, 22 year anniversary. We just celebrated on vacation. So, you know, none of that would have happened that way if I hadn't been injured. So most people are like, oh, do you miss it? Yeah, I miss it. I miss flying every day. But I decide who I am and how I show up in this world. And how I show up is not with one with regret, right? It's one of moving forward and helping other people.
So when we look at this, because the question was, how do you transition out of the military and into civilian life?
Not easily.
Well, you didn't even really transition. You just kind of like,
I was
jumped thrusted in.
Here you go.
This but is I how it's happening.
I mean, I see so many people that are properly processed, right? And do their time and properly processed out. And they struggle because it's such a loss of identity. It is a huge loss of identity.
Can you explain that a little bit?
Yeah. You are, in the military, you have a rank. You are a soldier, sailor, airman, you know, air person, whatever you want to call it, or now a guardian with the spaceport, right? Mm-hmm. You know who you are, and that becomes a part of who you are, because it's, you know, everything in the military is geared towards your rank, your job, what you do. You really don't have an identity outside of that. Even when you're not at work, you're in the evenings, you're with other people with your unit. You make friends with your unit fast because you're moving fast. Every 2 to 3 years, you're on the move. So you make friends fast, you bond fast, they become your family. When you get out of the military, you have none of that. It is isolating. You move into a community where it might be the community you grew up in, but you're not the same person.
Right.
And you move into somewhere new and you know no one. Like me, I knew no one when I moved back to tech. My dad was here. That was it. I didn't know anyone. And everyone I talked to already had friends that they'd grown up or went to college with or went to high school with. They didn't need new friends. So it was a really hard transition.
Yeah, I get that. I mean, even without the military aspect, I've lived where I've lived now for 10 years. And I, outside of the gal that sells me my beer,
priority.
I know a few people, but we don't, there's no barbecues because, you know, we're of a certain age. We didn't grow up together. We don't have that, the work bond because we all work from home or they got different jobs, that type of thing. It doesn't help that also I travel half the year. So there, it's difficult to keep that connection. What do you think, as we start to wrap up here, you know, what is leadership? What does it look like when you shift across, you know, industries and functions? Like what was the core leadership value that you got as a pilot?
I think as a pilot, The primary characteristic or value that I had was being intensely present in the moment.
Well, you kind of have to be. I mean, you're flying a mini 1,000-pound killing machine. It's
right. Right. So you had to be, but the saying in the helicopter, at least, is if you're not ahead, you're behind. Right. And so you're not just present out like that intensity of being present and anticipation of knowing, of always thinking about what this could happen. If this happens, I'm going to land there. If this happens, I'm going to land here. If this happens, I'm going to do this. Like, you're constantly so intensely present that there's no room for second guessing. There's no room to think back about what you did 5 minutes ago and then sit there and go, oh, I messed that up so bad. I'm going to let it sabotage everything I do for the rest of my life. Right? Because that's all we do. We do. We second guess ourselves and we backtrack and we think backwards and we are like, oh my God. And we let our past mistakes / learning opportunities define us or define our actions and our decisions and what we do going forward. And the fact is, everything you do starts right now.
So to kind of put this into perspective, from the most famous pilot ever, Maverick, of course,
I
if
was
you
going to
think you're dead.
say Amelia Earhart or Charles Lindbergh. Come on.
Well, but they're dead. No,
Maverick,
actually,
and Maverick is fictional. Come on.
Maverick is fictional. Absolutely.
I will say I didn't. I liked the new Maverick
Top
more
Gun
than Top Gun,
Maverick.
because, and I liked how they had female pilots. You know, they had Phoenix. They had a female pilot included in the mission and included in it, and they didn't make her a girlfriend. Thank
Right.
you, baby Jesus. I'm like, I am so like I watch these movies, like Wonder Woman. Oh my gosh, they had so many opportunities when they finally did a DC female protagonist, Wonder Woman, and then they made her go gooey eye over freaking Chris Pine's character, whatever his name was. So I'm like, you ruined it. You had every opportunity to show our young girls and the young girls in our lives to that they could be a heroine and a hero of their without a man, and then they so it makes me so mad. Because we have opportunities. We have opportunities to be role models. We have opportunities to do things that demonstrate to younger generations what strength and femininity and powers. Like, I wear my hair fun and curly and wear rhinestone bracelets and had rhinestones put on my own flight jacket because powerful women can be pretty too. And there's nothing wrong with it. And I just got into a big soapbox moment there. So sorry about that.
No, actually, I think it's fantastic. I mean, I have two daughters.
Oh, then you know what I'm
Yeah,
saying.
and I tried. I mean, I actually am the one that I ended up with custody. Not because starter life was bad, but I mean, she went back to school. She just didn't have time, that type of
Yeah.
thing. One of the things that I always tried to encourage both. I have an older, my oldest is a son, but the two girls was that you don't have to define yourself by what other people tell you. You can be whoever you want. And even beyond this, I told both of them, look, if you want to be a stay-at-home mom or a housewife, there's nothing wrong with that. You go for it. I think it's awesome. The only condition I have is that you have a marketable degree as well. And the reason it's really simple. If it ends up being a starter husband and you got to provide for yourself,
Back
or
up.
yeah, or he dies, right? I mean, things happen. So out of preparedness, even if you're going, if that is your mindset or your value center that you want to be a mom, right? There, and a stay-at-home mom at that, that's awesome. I firmly wish that I had had a stay-at-home mom. But you still have to be able to take care of yourself in case something happens, right? And I agree with you. I mean, I saw both Wonder Woman's. The first one I thought was okay. I mean, it was she's not that great of an actress, so it's kind of hard. But the second one was just terrible.
Horrible.
It's
84.
terrible. Yeah, it's just it's.
84 was horrible.
I mean,
I
so
mean,
many things wrong.
if you look at it from a societal standpoint, not a single person was happy with who they were.
Yeah.
What are we telling? What, again, what are we telling? I feel like we've lost the character and value base of our whole entertainment industry, right? Because it's entertainment, and we could have we. I mean, look at all these older movies that have these such great value systems emphasized in there, and we wonder why things have gotten not great for a lot of our youth because that's what they're watching, and they're thinking it's okay to want to be somebody you aren't. No, that's not okay. I mean, in the end, it all went bad, right? And they had to go back, but still, it's not okay. It's like you work on you. You do you. You figure out who you are, who you want to be, like, and stop trying to be somebody else.
And it's
Like it
not
just
how many followers you have, right? It's not how many likes you get or hearts or whatever else. It's
We're circling right back from the beginning, JD, talking about social media. So
I know it's
no, your self-worth is not based on your what they call it, a Q score, right? Yeah. That you have for your social media.
Like, okay, what is your self-worth based on? For all of our listeners who haven't figured this out, who are more interested in whether or not they can make a living on OnlyFans or be influencers, what is your self-worth?
Happy for those who can, but so here's the thing for me with self-worth. So I think self-worth is different than confidence, right? Sure. I think the formula I use is you must be confident to be competent in your work, right? If you show up wishy-washy, if you show up not having a good day, your work is going to suffer no matter what that work is. Like, I admittedly, being an influencer, you have to have a level of confidence to be on screen and handle and do everything that they do and stand up to haters and all the things that happen, right? But so your confidence drives competence, and you must have competence to achieve excellence. And none of that happens by accident. So it comes back, self-worth to me stems from confidence in how you show up and who you decide to be every single day. And more than that, but I think you have to determine what your self-worth is to you. And that is not the same as the person next to you, your best friend, the neighbors, your coworkers, or anybody else. Because if you don't know, and I think that's why most people, circling right back to the beginning, most people are dissatisfied with their lives and themselves and their work. And they can't find satisfaction because they think it's a destination. And it's not. It's a journey. It's knowing who you are, being confident in your own skin and how you show up, and then knowing what success means to you. So I think the biggest question I will push out for your listeners who have hung out this far with us, right, is what does success mean for you? And I will, if you're married or are in a relationship, ask what success means to them. Cause it's amazing. My husband and I did this activity, and it's amazing when the keeper husband, that is. And it's amazing. If those are different, you have different paths, and you have to find a way to find that commonality and a common path between the two. So like really knowing what success means and who you are and how you show up in those moments, that leads to that satisfaction, and that satisfaction leads to a higher level of self-worth.
I really liked that. I was going to go into a whole bunch of other things, but one, we're out of time, but two, I was going to ask you, right? It's like, what would you tell the listeners? And I didn't have to ask you. So that's awesome. You already had it.
And I'm super, super passionate about that. Like, I call them the confidence boosters. So if I can give your listeners, especially if they hung to the end or you want to put in the show notes or whatever, I have 3 confidence boosting strategies and an online course that I'd like to gift to everyone listening or linking or wherever they're at right now.
Okay. And how do we want to do that? Do you want to give them a shout?
Yeah, I have a link. Okay. I have a link that's $99. If you went to my website direct, it's $99. And I have people that have paid $99. But if you use this link I'm about to spell out for you, you will get it for free. The price will be overridden for free, which I give out for events that I speak at. And
okay.
Only the good podcasts.
Well, thank you. Let's do this. Instead of spelling it out, let's get Lindsay to get it from you, and we'll make sure it actually gets on the screen.
Everybody will get it on the screen. It's on the screen.
That's right. All right. With that, this has been More Than a Refresh, a podcast with conversations with the most interesting people you've never met and may never have heard of. And our guest today was Elizabeth McCormick, a former badass Black Hawk helicopter pilot, and now a present badass motivational leader. Would that be appropriate?
It'll work.
It'll work. All right.